You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community radio, solar-powered, broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa, on this lovely day in the springtime of 2016.
Well, it's cloudy, but it's not snowing. It's not icing. It's not so it's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline and our guest, I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. And if you're listening on Monday, it's morning, and I hope it's another nice day then.
So. And we have been away from the studio for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
We did broadcast some really interesting shows while we were gone. One was Ruta Sepetys with Salt to the Sea that we recorded beforehand.
Oh, yeah, that was a great
An amazing great historical fiction novel. And then we rebroadcast Magnus McFarlane Barrow with Mary's Meals because that's a very timely issue right now. Mm-hmm. They feed refugee and children all over the world. And who do we have with us today?
Well, today we have, Saida Hafiz, and she is the author of The Healing, a memoir of food, family, and yoga. And it is a voyage of discovery. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. And do we have a little background on Saida? I think it says she's been experiencing the power of her yoga practice and benefits of eating a whole foods diet for more than 20 years. She teaches basic holistic nutrition and yoga to kids and adults throughout the San Francisco Bay Area. Saida is a graduate of Temple University in Philadelphia and studied at the Sivananda Yoga Vedanta Centers and Ashrams and the Natural Gourmet in New York. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Saida.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And I think you've been to Fairfield before, haven't you?
I have. One of my closest friends, who's also a writer, Rochelle Chase. She is. She lives there, and I visited, and it's a lovely place. Kind of like a best kept secret. And I thought, it's to retire.
That's not a bad idea. Although I will say that San Francisco weather is a little more moderate than what we have here.
We have a gorgeous day here today.
Well, spring and fall are pretty lovely, mm-hmm. and winter and summer are beautiful too, but pretty extreme sometimes, not always. I think we have maybe the broadest temperature range of almost anywhere because we can go from 20 below to 110 in a year. So, I mean, those are real extremes.
Yeah, for sure.
They don't happen very often, but it's possible. So. Right. So, Saida, tell us how you came to write The Healing.
Well, when I started, like a lot of things, I didn't set out to write a book. I was wanting to put together a basic calendar with some healing information that I was learning as I was in classes in whole foods nutrition as well as yoga. And basically, I wanted to just have sort of a nice recipe card or a section on the calendar with some basic yoga postures that kind of worked within the season. And I had solicited that idea to a lot of publishers and printers, and one of the publishers came back and said, we love this concept, but we would like for it to be a book. Mm. And I know, long story. I didn't necessarily know how to write a book. But the idea kept coming towards me around documenting my experience with whole foods nutrition and yoga, and what it ended up turning into is a memoir, because a lot of healing had to happen, and, you know, hence the name, The Healing. And it took me on this journey that I would have never sketched out for myself, but it's been kind of remarkable.
Saida,
that's kind of how it all started, as a calendar, and now it is a book.
And how long ago was the calendar concept? Were you working on that? Was it quite a while
ago? Okay, hold on to your hat. About 17 years ago.
You know, that's not that unusual, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. Good.
For a first book to have spend many, many years in gestation.
Well, that's what I started to understand as I was meeting different writers and talking to coaches, taking classes. A lot of people were saying their first book, on average, I was getting around 12 years. And I thought, oh, that makes a lot of sense, you know, considering that I hadn't even started thinking about a book, and that it would take that time for me to come to this. And I really feel that it's part of the journey, too. The writing kind of has been the icing on the cake with moving into a holistic health lifestyle.
You said you took classes and went to conferences and so forth. What did you find particularly helpful in that process? Were there certain teachers that you found or coaches that that were really helpful?
Yes, I have run into some amazing teachers and coaches. And one of the things is I worked with one woman named Rachel Howard, and she was phenomenal. And what she would do is, as I was putting things on the page, she could look at it from this literary standpoint and begin to tell me, something's missing here. Your character's not fully developed. The reader's not going to believe you, and which has been fascinating. And at the same time, I was sending sections to a therapist I had been working with, Victoria Butterworth, and she would pretty much the same exact places say, you're not telling the full truth here, you're holding back. And both of these people were 3,000 miles apart and they don't know each other.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yes, it was chilling. And what really was exciting for me around this was that when I work with writing coaches, it really is, even if it's fiction, that your character must be on the page and people must be able to follow with you exactly where you're going, and that it needs to be believable. And that was so lovely and connected to therapy of, are you becoming your full, most dynamic self? Are people going to believe who you are? And the two were merging for me, coming from, you know, this therapeutic background, clinical psychologist, with someone who's looking at just good writing. And I thought, that's the mystery in life. You have to be able to stand in your truth and be your full self. And so it was like these light bulbs went off for me about how to be a true, honest person, you know, living in today's society.
Well, I think, you know, kind of the buzzword for that is authenticity.
Yes.
Yeah. And for a writer, you know, authenticity is harder than it sounds, because when in one-on-one, you can be authentic with somebody because you know your audience and you can react and respond to them. And if it's something that somebody that you feel uncomfortable talking about, some authentic truth about yourself, you just don't have that conversation with that person. You don't have to. But when you're writing, you don't know who's going to read it.
That's right, you don't.
And
I think that...
Yeah, so it may be difficult to let your guard down to... I mean, I think with a memoir, it is difficult to let your guard down and really show yourself, warts and all.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And I think that was a big leap for me, because when the initial publisher said they wanted a book, I was off figuring out how to do a how-to book, how to tell people what to do. And when all was said and done, it was no. People want to know what you've experienced,
mm-hmm.
and how and why you're able to say you can try this or follow your true path. So that was also eye-opening of having that difference of, yeah, there are a lot of people that can say do this, but if they haven't experienced or lived it or understood it in a deep way, how is someone else going to understand and feel it for themselves?
Absolutely, yeah. And one of the things that impressed me about your book, and I wrote this in the blog post on KRUUFM.com, is that a lot of times people write about being on a spiritual path, eating a healthy diet, and it's all roses, you know? It's all, oh, here's all the benefits. Here's how great it is. Here's how my life changed. Ooh, look at me. And that's not what your book is.
No, it's not. And I wanted it to be that way. I really did. I wanted to just say, oh, I followed these four things and life was great. But, you know, the hurts or the trauma or the vision that I had for myself went deeper. So I had to really face a lot of the demons and then really carve out who it is I wanted to be within the world. So there were a lot of things to face. And I felt, what I can say is I felt that the practice of, you know, eating as well as I could and practicing yoga gave me the fortitude to really face a lot of things. And I'm definitely not saying be perfect in those aspects, but having an anchor for them. Because there are times when I don't want to practice yoga or eat well. I still have to figure out what's most important and how I can persevere through life.
Well, I think a lot of people don't eat well. A lot of people don't eat well.
Yeah.
Because we're a culture of fast food and, you know.
Well, and also there's a lot of talk now about food deserts. Places,
yes.
You know, inner city often where the healthy food just is not available or not available at a price that people mm-hmm. living there can afford.
Mm-hmm.
Did you grow up in one of those food deserts, Saida?
No, not necessarily. I grew up in a couple of different neighborhoods. And on one hand, you know, we had access to fresh fruits and vegetables. But when you're living with a single mom who's working, you really are just trying to make things, you know, ends meet. If my mom's phrase is, you know, catch as catch can. And you're doing something where you're just trying to get by. And a lot of times it's out of convenience. So
yeah.
We would find ourselves eating fast food or fast restaurant food. You know, she'd clip a coupon where... you know, adults pay, the kids eat free, that kind of thing, or two for one. Or, you know, the freezer would be stocked with pretty much frozen foods that were not that nutritious. And so, yeah, the foundation there was kind of shaky. But the interesting thing is, you know, I've been teaching in the school district for several years, and I see a lot of the food deserts that affect our kids and how to help them maneuver that. So, you know, dealing with the food bank or having different farmers markets come to the school site. There was even an aspect where there was a tourism population that was growing fresh fruits and veggies, and they would bring them to different schools for the parents to basically have fresh fruits and vegetables that way. On one hand, I had access growing up to fruits and vegetables, but a lot of it was a matter of time. So the time wasn't created to make home meals.
Right. And if you're not used to it, you don't necessarily know. You know, even if somebody hands you a zucchini, you don't know really what to do with it.
Exactly.
Now, one thing I found interesting in your book was that when how you actually got on to the more healthier eating. It was sort of accidental in a way. Do you want to describe that? Or
yeah, I do. And maybe I'll read the section that that's looking at the flavors of my life. And basically, I had saw a flyer. I was, you know, had my I graduated college, got my corporate job, and I wanted to, in a sense, aspire to be middle class. And I thought, okay, so I have this corporate income coming in. How do I take care of myself so that I basically can have the fortitude and the energy to run with the corporate players, you know, corporate men in banking primarily. And so I saw a flyer that said cooking class, and I noticed it was in one of the neighborhoods that I considered pretty middle class in Pittsburgh, Squirrel Hill, and thought, oh, I'll sign up for that. And I didn't even read it carefully because I just assumed it was going to be sort of creams and sauces or something like a Julia Child, and ended up getting into a natural foods cooking class, and where we were looking at food as medicine. And so one of the things that came with that is the instructor would come to your house and do an in-home consultation. And so I signed up for one of those. So I'll read the section that's called Chapter 4, The Flavors of My Life.
Okay, this is Saida Hafiz reading from The Healing, a memoir of food, family, and yoga.
So tasting the sweetness of Savasana, and that's the yoga posture. Hearing the voice during the forward bend pose and revisiting my childhood trauma were just the start of my holistic journey. When I signed up for my first cooking class, I was simply doing something that I perceived would move me into the middle class. I didn't realize that I would be challenged to integrate all of my different flavors into a healthier and more self-caring version of myself. I wanted to learn more about this holistic lifestyle and how I could participate in creating my own good health. Holistic Wellness regularly sent newsletters to my home, but it was the personalized letter that Gia sent to me that encouraged me to schedule an in-home consultation. The letter seemed to speak directly to my need to rebuild my shaky foundation. After getting the letter, I immediately called Gia to schedule an appointment. She came to my house in a way I imagined doctors made house calls in the 1950s. But she didn't look like a physician. She wore loose-fitted, natural fabric, a kind of middle-aged Eileen Fisher chic. The way she moved in her clothes showed an easy flow with nature. I admired that about her. After our initial greetings, examined my whole life, my surroundings. I had never received this kind of attention from anyone. She made me feel like everything in my life mattered, that it had contributed to who I am. I felt like I mattered. I must admit, that was a new feeling. Gia pulled out her client notebook and glanced at the intake form. I fixated on her fingernails. They were short and manicured, but not polished. They were not like the nails I saw on the professional women in the corporate world, which were lengthened with gel, silk, or acrylic, and polished flawlessly. Gia's hands looked strong, natural, and yet beautiful. As she talked, I listened raptly. Saida, the basis of holistic health is to have our internal world be at peace with our external world. She went on to ask me about my sleep, menstrual cycle, a significant other, family, and friends. Gia was like a doctor who made house calls, but she also went a little deeper, like a psychologist, a clergyman, and a friend. Nothing was off limits. I got the impression that my health mattered to her. She explained that outside things affected how we express peace and harmony, or dis-ease, and disharmony, and vice versa. Holistic health looks at the whole picture, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, and not to mention financially. She talked about being at peace with it all. After Gia took inventory regarding how I viewed my life, we visited my kitchen. Opening a small beige metal cupboard door revealed two boxes of Cracklin' Oat brand and tomato sauce. The other four boxes and jars were in the freezer, since I stockpiled two-for-one coupons, just like my mother. I had bow tie pasta noodles, herbal teas, orange juice, milk, bread, ketchup, and a few fresh fruits and vegetables. One onion, several stalks of celery, a carrot, and a few apples. I also had the remains of my bulk cooking ingredients from the class. Brown rice, lentils, steel-cut oats, barley, and shiitake mushrooms. I handed the Cracklin' Oat brand to Gia. She showed me how the cereal contained multi-forms of sugar products, all of them refined. We examined most of the food items in my cupboard, refrigerator, and freezer. I was amazed that so many items were loaded with sugar. My dry cereal, tomato sauce, ketchup, even my bread. Not only did sugar appear in everything, I learned it was listed under different aliases, such as cane sugar, brown sugar, corn syrup, sucrose, maltodextrose, and high fructose corn syrup. Gia departed, leaving me with lots of information and food recipes to make. I thought long and hard about what she suggested. I could slowly phase out these items or give them all away and start fresh with better quality food. She encouraged me to cook and share meals with others. I was committed to following her instructions, even if I didn't like to cook that much. I didn't realize it at the time, but what I did was a radical detox. No processed food, no sugar, only whole food meals. I learned later that my regular consumption of refined sugar, both known and unknown, affected my pancreas, insulin levels, and my liver, a place to store sugar as fat. Sugar made me tired and grumpy, especially during premenstrual time, but mostly I felt spaced out and numb. When I stopped consuming sugar, I experienced a chemical withdrawal, similar to my Uncle Paul's heroin withdrawal. I became depressed, yet I was no longer fuzzy. I was less irritable and fatigued. I was in the process of sobering up. Even if it was challenging, I knew it was the right thing for my body and my mind. The detox reminded me of a time when I went through the entire fourth grade without knowing something was wrong with my eyesight. By fifth grade, I had my eyes tested, and lo and behold, I needed glasses. With glasses, I could see much better. I didn't like everything I saw at school or in my neighborhood or at home, but at least everything was clear. The three-day detox had a similar effect to wearing glasses. I didn't like what I saw, but the picture was clear. At Gia's advising, I made a broth called Sweet Veggie Drink. It nourishes the pancreas and helps eliminate processed sugar cravings. I wanted to add a kind of sweetness to my body that was not experienced in a quick or refined way, but rather in a way that lingered. This was how I was starting to feel about life. Since I was no longer numb by the wrong kind of sweetness, and I sensed that I wanted to taste a richer and fuller life, I didn't want instant gratification anymore. I wanted to experience life's flavors in a healthy way. I wanted a delicious life where my inside environment was at peace with my outside environment. So I took inventory of my life, from what was in my cupboard to what was in my heart, and I found flavors that were sour, pungent, and bitter. So that was chapter four, and we're just basically discovering getting rid of sort of the sugar and the refined foods and starting to see some of the past events and how life is for me at that time.
Now, Saida, in addition to the memoir part of the book, you also have a section that has some of the recipes that you talk about and some of the yoga poses also, and with you modeling the yoga poses. So I just looked for the sweet veggie drink, which has butternut, squash, carrots, cabbage, and onion and water. Doesn't sound very sweet.
Well, you know, okay, so they're the sweet veggies of the butternut, squash, and the carrot, and the onions as well. And so when you begin to, you know, you layer those veggies in a pot and you simmer for 30 minutes, and basically you're drinking the broth of it, hot or cold, and no, it's not a sweetened beverage like you would have soda, but it is sort of a savory sweet broth that you can sip on that really does help to balance out your blood sugar levels.
And it's easy. It sounds like it's pretty easy to make.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to make. You just chop the veggies pretty much in chunks. You'll layer them and then you'll add the water, and you'll just bring to a simmer, a boil, and then simmer, and then you strain off the broth to drink. And some people can use the veggies if they want to puree them for soup later. They can, instead of just pitching them. And I've had it even, you know, I've added some raisins to those veggies and just sort of had it as a side dish. Mm-hmm. But it's really the broth that, at this point, to help the body regulate the pancreas, particularly when you're detoxing like that.
Now, refined sugar is different than natural sugar that comes in fruits and some vegetables, too.
Yes, a lot of the refined sugar has been heavily processed, and some people have said that if they were to make table sugar today as if it were never used before, that it may not pass the FDA because it's processed often like cocaine.
Oh.
or a really refined process there. So it goes into the bloodstream really quick. It definitely changes how the brain experiences sweetness and sugar into the body. So it's quite a quick high. And so, yeah, I think if it was developed today, it may not pass the U.S. The FDA.
Wow. You're listening.
And it's in everything.
Yeah. And what's even worse is the high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so a lot of that, you know, excess of what to do with the corn and those things, and then it becomes cheap. It's been subsidized on some level by the government, so mm-hmm. It's easier for people to use it as a food additive, and it helps to preserve things, I think, a little bit longer on the shelf.
Right.
So, yeah, be careful.
It's very hard.
It is true. And you know, many ways to do it. And I don't say do what I did in terms of, you know, giving all the food away and starting fresh with fruits and veggies. But that was my path, and I'm glad that I did.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Saida Hafiz, author of The Healing, a memoir of food, family, and yoga. Now, when you started on this path and you started eating more healthily, you had it brought some stuff up from the past, didn't it?
It did. And, you know, I thought I was going to start with chapter one. but, you know, that was such a profound change in me that, you know, I would see often, you know, movies growing up, and they would talk about drug addiction and then things that people were hiding from or they felt shameful about and they had to face in order to move through. And I think in hindsight, realizing that was happening to me just from detoxing from processed foods and sugars was pretty astounding. And I would like to read that first chapter because, again, I was seeking one thing. Again, I just was trying to move into middle class and make my family proud of me. But I found some other things along the way. So if it's okay to go in.
Sure, let's do that.
Okay. So chapter one, on the bus. Pittsburgh seemed like 20 degrees as I waited for the bus. 71 A. Negley. It was late winter 1990, and I just wanted to be at home in my new apartment, warm, comfortable, and safe. When it arrived, I quickly got on, tucking my long black wool coat around me. I nestled myself between two other passengers. I removed my burgundy leather gloves, placed them inside my matching coach purse, and looked down at my wet mahogany boots. In this outfit, I felt like an African-American career girl from Essence Magazine. As a 23-year-old corporate marketing database manager, I was that girl from the 1970s TV show, which portrays a woman who chooses to have a career first instead of getting married and starting a family. So between that girl and Essence Magazine, I had grown up to be that black girl. As the bus drove to the next stop, I wiped the steam from my glasses, and suddenly tears crowded into my eyes. The ding from the stop requested bell transported me back to a scene from my past. I'm 5 years old. My father comes home from being out late. The door slams shut. And just like that, ding that started the Ollie Frazier fight that I'd watched on TV, I hear a ding inside my head, signaling that the fight in my house was about to begin. All night, I listen to my father beating my mother. The next day, I see her black eye peeking out from behind her dark sunglasses. Even though I was looking down, I knew that we were passing the Kaufman Department Store building with its spring collection in the window, an image I see twice daily, month after month, as I rode the bus back and forth to work. Again, I heard a ding. I'm 11. And I'm sitting beside my paternal grandmother. She pulls bright, shiny brass knuckles from a brown paper bag. Drunk, she whispers, "Your grandfather used the thief on me. Don't ever let a man hit you." I look toward the bus driver, then out of his partially defogged window. The round dormitory buildings belong to the University of Pittsburgh. Ding! I am 13. And my mother has just thrown a sewing box filled with sharp needles, scissors, thimbles, and thread at my younger brother. It misses him. Head hung low, teeth grinding, hands shaking. I pull the cord hard. Ding, inside my head, I yell, "Stop, I want to get off." At Negley and Ellsworth, I staggered off the bus, wondering why I was suddenly having these horrifying memories for the first time. My legs shook as I walked across the street toward my apartment. Blinded by my tear-speckled eyeglasses, I fumbled for my keys. Emotionally exhausted, the small flight of stairs left me winded. I opened the door to my apartment, took off my coat to the floor. Back against the wall, I looked around at the empty rooms. Bare walls, curtainless windows, seeing only a futon mattress for sleeping, an expensive all-clad cooking pot, a professional chef's knife, and a second-hand, fine china dish set. It wasn't that I couldn't afford to begin furnishing my place. The truth was that I wasn't sure I wanted to. I didn't want to fill it up with the should-have from the latest TV commercials. It was my first place, and I wanted to decide what furnishings best represented me. Part of me liked not having furniture. It gave me the feeling of building a new life from the ground up. I started to cry again, and my salty tears came down like a monsoon, with snot hanging from my nose. I sat on the floor like a four-year-old hugging my knees. Then I heard the voice of my mother inside my head. "What are you crying for? I was the one who suffered all those beatings. Girl, you better go on and be happy. You got a good job. You make almost 3 times more than I do. You have a college degree and your own apartment. You're not one of those single black mothers raising babies. Just go on and be happy. You made it." I cried even harder. Had I made it? Did I want for me what society, black America, and my mother wanted for me? I continued to sit on the floor, and more violent images appeared in my mind's eye. My body flinched each time I remembered a scream or a loud thump from my childhood. But it was the memories of long periods of silence from childhood that were the scariest. I never knew if the fight for the night was over. So my eyes would shift back and forth in the darkness of my bedroom, waiting. Even though Pittsburgh seemed like 20 degrees that day, the memories of my past were just beginning to thaw out. That's chapter one.
From The Healing by Saida Hafiz.
So you had a lot of baggage to deal with.
Yes, I did. yeah, it was, like I said, it was really kind of fascinating that, you know, as I kind of went through the days later of understanding and connecting that what I had done differently was, you know, not have processed foods or sugar in my diet, and it gave me a chance to kind of what I call thaw out or not feel numb anymore, and to really just look at my history and where I come from and how, you know, initially that felt really shameful. And then I started looking at, well, what had I been eating this whole time? It was, you know, fast food. Breakfast was often just grabbing a donut. And when I was in college, I remember having lollipops just about every morning. So after having the campus breakfast. And so that was just really, I realized that I was just sort of continuing to numb my feelings and not look at those experiences and just trying to be normal, you know.
So for you,
there I was.
Sugar really was your drug.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
sugar was the drug for me.
And at least it was better than other choices you could have made in terms of drugs?
Yes, particularly because, you know, as the reader will see, my brothers and sisters made different choices to alleviate their pain.
Mm-hmm.
And choices they're still trying to fight back from, you know, the more drug, the hard drug addiction, which is just hard. And
I remember reading in one of your brothers, in, I think it was your brother, who seemed to be doing really, really well and then fell back into it again.
Yes.
Yeah.
And according to sort of the Facebook pages now, he's much better again. So, you know, you just kind of keep an eye on it. And the interesting thing is there's been good reception from family members about the book, even though it shows all of my work. It also highlights there.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because that's a big issue for people writing memoir, because it isn't just your story that you're telling. It's your story of the people
right.
around you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you, did you hold back at all for the because of that? Or do you think that's part of why it took so long to complete it?
At first, I may have been holding back, and yes, that's why it took longer to complete it. What was happening with me was, you know, again, my writing coaches really were wonderful, like Constance Hale, and I worked with Janice Cook Newman, and or do I convert her, mix her name, Janice Newman Cook? they basically. Their encouragement is put it on the page. You have to get it out first. And then you can look at it and then decide what supports the story and what doesn't support the story. Then from there, there was a point where I had put it on the page and we did the editing. And I remember this one summer before going to print that I thought, oh boy, you know, this can be really embarrassing to my family.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my tactics to keep writing was, well, they've embarrassed you for years.
You know?
And then I was at a standstill, and I remember one of the, you know, I work in a school district, so I have summers off to do intensive writing. And I remember one of the summers I just sat there. You know, I show up for writing, but I couldn't get anything ready to go. And after weeks and weeks, a message came to me that said, you need to send this to your parents and let them know that you are most likely going to be in print. You're sending this to them as a courtesy and go from there. You know, so I sent it to them, and I also sent it to my brother. And several things came back, which was really surprising. My brother, the one that you make reference to, he has his degree in writing and literature, and he told me, be as honest and raw as you can be. You have to say the truth.
Wow.
And yeah, I was shocked. And my father came back with, well, I was not the man I wanted to be. So he didn't deny it. He just said, yeah, these things happen, and I was not the man I wanted to be, having gotten into this bar business. And so that was shocking. My mother, her stance was, well, one is if it can help other women and families be honest with themselves. She says she feels that it should get out there to every woman and child who comes from an abusive household, to help them with their struggles, which was really good. And she also said something to the effect of, she said, well, it all happened. So they really kind of put their arms around the fact that the truth was on the page. And I remember my mother asking me at one point, when I'm using some dialogue to talk about a conversation that she and I had, and she said, you know, did I really sound like that? And she wasn't defensive when she asked the question. And my response to her, and this is also for others who are writing memoir, I said, that was my experience of you in that situation. So I could honestly say, this is how I experienced the situation. Whether or not you were really like that, you know, as they say, there's your side, my side, and then there's the truth.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And that's all I could stand in. And you know, and tell her from my most open heart, that is how I experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when others are talking about hard situations with families, whether they're writing it or having hard conversations, you can only stand in, this was my interpretation of how I experienced your words or your actions or non-actions. And that was so freeing. And when I told my writing coaches about their response, one gal in particular said, well, I feel that what you put on the page isn't necessarily pointing the finger at them. You're just saying, here are these events, and this is how this affected me, and this is how I want to heal from it. And they said, from that point, how can someone find fault with it when you are just clear and honest in that way and just saying, this is how I want to get better? They felt that I didn't blame anyone in the telling of the story, which I thought was interesting, too.
That was, well, as obviously you did a good job of that, because it could have been hurtful, and apparently it was not. And so that's good.
One thing that other memoir writers have said sometimes when they showed the book to people who are close to them or showed a manuscript, that they would get back a correction, some minor detail, you know, that doesn't really have any effect on the story. And for example, I think one said, no, your father didn't give me that coat. That was from my mother, or something like that.
Yes. Right.
So you didn't have that happen?
No, I didn't have that. Well, I do remember my brother said something about, like, grandma drank gin, not whiskey. And I was like, well.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Both.
Yeah. That kind of thing.
Well, and there was one or two love interests in the story that one guy doesn't want to talk to me. Mm. And we had one small exchange, and he said, the truth hurts, and it's going to take a lot of heal. So again, he didn't
Didn't deny the truth of what you wrote.
Didn't deny it.
Yeah.
Just said it's going to take a while to heal. And then another love interest, I said, this is going to go to print, and I just want to give you the courtesy. He took the information, and he never responded. And I said, you can give me any feedback you want. I may not change anything, but I'm open to it.
And that was good.
I never heard anything.
That was a good way to approach it, though.
Yeah, I mean, so, and that was the thing where I felt I gave pretty much people involved an opportunity to respond. I mean, you know, people that I still really feel that I care about a lot.
Okay, you refer to, in one point, the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People strategies.
Yes.
How did you apply that to what you were doing?
Well, you know, I really, and I still use the calendar of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, because the way that they ask you to look at the different sections in your life is a very holistic way. You get to define how you show up. You know, are you an author, a business owner? Are you a father, a mother? Are you an employee? And then in those areas, they have you look at what are, say, the top 3 things I need to do in each of these areas to show up and be that person, you know, or be that whole person. And so I like how they have that situated where, you know, they use this metaphor of what are the big rocks, what are the big priorities, and then you can fill in with sort of the smaller pebbles and sand. Mm. And I find that being able to break things down in that way, I'm able to do even some nice small action items in areas that I care about and keep those connections. And then I also get to watch, okay, well, you say you care about this, but you're not doing any action there. Do you really care about it or not? And so it really helps me kind of look at how to be holistic with all the different areas that I care about in life.
So it's the whole thing is
a compass guide.
The whole thing is a work in progress then, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, and that's the thing where, you know, the title of the book, The Healing, in and of itself, is something that you can look at. Yeah, okay, so I did some healing from the past, but then also it's a very present word. I'm doing some healing right now in the present, and then going forward in the future, there's going to be some things, if I'm participating fully, I'm sure to make some mistakes along the way, and we'll have to have some new healings to come about. So it's really a past, present, future title. And again, and in this case, you know, a memoir of food, family, and yoga. But I guess over time, all those things can change and interplay.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Saida Hafiz, author of The Healing, a memoir of food, family, and yoga. Saida, how did you decide when you were ready to go to print? You know, when was, you know, how did you know the book was done?
Well, yeah, one of the things that I really, you know, particularly being, again, what I might call new to writing, it's really this thing where you can always be making edits to something. And then you just decide you're going to stop writing and go from there. So my last developmental editor, Nora Isaac, she basically was telling me about that. She said, yeah, you can tweak things forever. But then there's a point where you just say, okay, we're done here. And put the blessings on it and go to print. And that's pretty much what I had to do because, you know, she helped me, I think, take out 20,000 words could have been more, because it's already lengthy, and just imagine there was more. And it was really deciding, like, okay, do we have everything in here that's pertinent to the story?
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically how I decided to. Yeah, it felt. That was the other thing too. And this happened with every writing session for me. Like, I'd show up, and it might be hard to get started with the writing, but when you really go through it, there's this natural place of, like, yes. And I felt good about the book.
So did you tend to write in short little, you know, blips or long chunks of time? And were there times where you set it aside and didn't work on it at all?
Yes. So when I started, I was in class and with Janice Cook Newman, and basically we could turn in 2,000 words a week. And then we'd meet once a week and we'd have people read. And what I realized was, if I followed her formula, it's costing me a nickel a word to get the feedback. And I thought, I want my money's worth. So I committed to showing up to the 2,000 words a week, and I would hand those in. And she would give feedback, and you always had to turn in something new. You couldn't do a rewrite, and which I really liked, because then, you know, by the end of her course, you had probably at least 10,000 words or so
mm-hmm.
on something. And so that would happen. Then I'd have my own momentum where I would show up in coffee shops, and I would just say, okay, I don't know what I'm going to write today, but I'm sitting here from 10 a.m. to 2.
Mm.
And I'll have lunch here, and we'll see what comes about, you know. And then I'd have other little tricks with people where I'd say, okay, I, you know, must turn in this chapter to you by, you know, a certain date, and would work on that. And so I really did my best to keep the momentum going in all kinds of ways. And so sometimes I could only do a paragraph or a page. And other times, you know, I set the time between, okay, you're going to be here from 10 to 2, but it turned out I was there from 10 to 10 at night.
Oh, my goodness.
Through, and, you know, it just had a rhythm to it. And I gave myself little prompts of things to say. And I will have to tell you, about 4 years ago, I sat down because I was really at a stuck point, and I wasn't sure it was even going to be a book, and I was burning certain copies at the beach, and, you know, I had it. And then I realized that I thought, okay, I know they have this sort of National Writing Month in November.
Right.
Well, for me, yes. For me, it was October, and I just decided that I was going to take an old composition notebook, and I was only going to use pencil. But every night after work, I would come home and write from about 5 o'clock to 9 o'clock. And I was the question to myself was, what do you want to tell your niece about our family?
Mm-hmm.
So I just write and write and write. And that's basically the skeleton version of the book that you see before you. And that's why I dedicate it to my nieces and nephews, my one niece specifically. This was what I wanted to tell her as to how and why our family is the way it is. That's from my perspective.
I wondered if you kept a journal along the way, because there were so many details about things, you know.
Yeah. I have about 50 journals since 2001. I think I was 14. And I've always kept a journal, a place to see my thoughts on the page. And if I believe those thoughts, you know, because tons of thoughts come in and out. And it was just a really nice way to release a lot of tension and frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, to go back to my journals, I go back to my therapy notes, you know, and then I have my writing coach, who was new to all of it, you know, and was able to mm-hmm. say, character's not developed here.
Yeah.
So,
Saida, how did you publish the book?
So I did have a publisher interested. but the terms I didn't particularly like, and you lose all your rights. So at this point, I did self-publishing, and I had some really interesting, talented people step up to design the cover. Someone who has won awards in the big arena, works for a major design firm, and found a really nice printer that was able to give me the quality of the paper. The same design person did the inside. We looked at font. I can't even tell you how many meetings I had about font and what they, you know, communicate emotionally to people.
It's amazing how important the visual impact of a book can be.
Yeah. And I, you know, it was one of those things where when this cover came about, because we had some different covers to choose from, and this was actually one of the last one. And it was strange because I thought, well, it's I don't know if this will make sense. It's not necessarily my first choice, but I know it's the right choice.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I think it was.
Yeah, it was. And so...
Well, Saida, we only have about a minute left. Can you tell us, are you going to continue writing? Are you looking at another book or maybe the calendar idea again?
I'm not sure. A few people have asked me to do some writing. A few people have had dreams and said that they've already seen my second book come out, which I thought was encouraging. And so I think for this particular, for now, in the next several months, I'm going to continue to do some promotion and maybe look at doing some writing later in the year or the beginning of next year.
Wow. Let me get the
book. And we'll see about the calendar. It is a great idea.
It is, yeah.
And it would be interesting to see if the healing gets picked up.
And I know your book is available on Amazon, and also you have your own website. Do you want to give us that?
Yes. So it's saidahafiz.com, and that's SAEEDAHAFIZ.com. And there's ways to buy the paperback copy, an e-version as well. And there's different things on the website there. And, yeah, and if people want to do wholesale for resale in their bookshop, they can... contact me through the website.
Great, and it is a beautiful website. And we always encourage people to buy from local bookstores whenever possible to support the bookstore. Second, go to the author's website or go to writersvoices.com. You can click through to Amazon on there and help support Writers' Voices, too.
Yeah, I'm in Boston at the Harvard bookstore, and I'm at Elliott Bay Books in Seattle, so there's some coast-to-coast things in Iowa as well, in Fairfield.
Awesome. Probably at Revelations here in Fairfield.
Revelations, that's right.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Mom, do you have some closing words?
Oh, yeah,
this
is perfect, I think. It's perfect for her, for this whole thing. It's Abraham Lincoln once said, "Be sure you put your feet in the right place and then stand firm."
Mm-hmm. Stay tuned now for Planet Earth's Wild if you're listening on Monday or on Friday. And if you're listening on Monday, have a great week. Rebroadcast Monday, 8 a.m. Podcast available at writersvoices.com. See you next week on Writers Voices.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com.